and welcome to episode 73 of A Gamer Looks at 40. I'm Bill Tucker. Now, a few months ago, I had the honor and privilege to guest on the Player One podcast with Mr. Greg Seward. You know him well from this show and mostly probably from the Player One podcast. And on that show was Chris from Classic Gaming Quarterly. And it was a great recording. We had a great time just doing the show and talking about games. It was a lot of fun. And I said to Chris, hey, man, I'd love for you to be on my show at some point if you'd like. And a lot of times when I make that offer, the other person goes, oh, yeah. And I reach out and it doesn't happen. Or something occurs and it just dies on the vine, as they say. Well, Chris was very kind enough to actually respond to my email and Twitter DM and join me for an interview on this very show. So I'm super excited to have him. It was an awesome interview. If you don't know his work, Chris's Classic Gaming Quarterly YouTube channel focuses on large topics like console releases and system retrospectives in a documentary style format that's very similar to your gaming historian. And what I love about his work is that he has achieved some really great traction. He has an excellent community, and he's done so by creating videos that are not clickbaity. They're not wacky faces. There's not sensationalism. He just creates these really solidly made YouTube documentaries about really fascinating subjects. He also does a lot of what he calls Let's Reads, which are basically he reads through old video game magazines. He recently did a Super Nintendo launch issue of EGM, which was fantastic. Really fun to watch him go through those memories and kind of experience them with him. Really great YouTuber, and I'm super happy to have him on the show. So let's jump into the conversation as Chris and I talk about his history with games, his road to creating videos on YouTube, and what lies ahead for him and his channel. Let's jump into it. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Obviously, you've had some really good success on YouTube and other places. And I want to take this time not only to kind of learn about how you got to this point as a content creator or, you know, a video creator, however, whatever term you like, but also kind of just learn, like, how did you get into games, kind of your history with it, some of those kind of big tentpole moments. And yeah, man, just kind of learn more about you and kind of how you got to where you are now. And pick your brain a bit too about content creation, because I think there's a lot of people out there who start channels and, you know, they'll see somebody like you or other YouTubers and say, wow, how can I get to that spot, right? Because there's a lot of work involved, I'm sure. So yeah, man, first things first, kind of like what's kind of your history with games? How'd you get started with video games? You know, first console, all that fun stuff.
Yeah. So I guess important point, I was born in 1977, just to give people sort of a frame of reference.
Cool.
So, okay. You know, I grew up playing a lot of arcade games. Like, you know, it was still very common to have, you know, arcade, like dedicated arcades that you would go to. There was, you know, seemingly every restaurant you went to, you know, like you'd go to a restaurant and it's like, oh, it's going to be 5 minutes for your table or whatever. And there'd be like, you know, a Pac-Man arcade cabinet sitting there like in the lobby.
Right.
And so, you know, most of my early video gaming was done on arcade machines, wherever they may be. But I also had, this is like first or second grade, so we'd be talking about, you know, like 1983 probably. My best friend had an Atari 5200. So, you know, I used to go over to his house almost every day after school.
Right.
And play a lot of games there. And, you know, some of the games he had were games that I already recognized from the art. Like every game he had, I think, was like an arcade port. And so either I was like, oh, I know this game, you know, from the arcade, or subsequently I'd go to an arcade and see a game and realize, oh, I played that game over at Jonathan's house. So,
Cool.
That was very cool. And like one place we lived had just, it's still the greatest arcade I think I've ever been in my life. And nice. It's funny because it was like this little small mountain town, but if people were driving from, I live in Northern California, if people were driving from Sacramento, which is the state capital, up to Lake Tahoe, which is sort of, you know, a famous, you know, vacation resort type place to go.
Right.
This place was where I lived was like on the highway between the two. And so this guy very smartly had set up this business where it was like a sports bar, like an old timey sports bar. And then it just had a humongous arcade in it. And,
wow.
And we lived in that town. And so it was, you know, pretty common that we would all go down there because, like, you know, my parents could sit in the bar and, you know, watch a game and have a drink or two. And, you know, my dad would just keep shoveling quarters into my hand and I could just go into the arcade and I got to see, you know, a lot. And this, again, this would have been in like 1984.
Wow.
So, you know, there were just so many great, or, you know, my favorites that I remember from there, they had, you know, Pole Position 2, which I loved, but I remember playing like Punch Out, but my favorite was they had the sit down Spy Hunter arcade cabinet. And
ooh, I don't think I even know this one.
Yeah, this was like, you know, you'd have to get in the cabinet, you know, and it had the speakers behind you and everything.
Oh, cool.
And that's an example of a game that I originally played Spy Hunter at Jonathan's house on his Atari 5200. Mm-hmm. And it was only after that I played it in the arcade and was just like, wow, you know, this is so much. Most people go the opposite direction, right? You play a game in the arcade and then you go home and play it on your Atari. And it's like, well, you know, this is the best approximation we can have.
Sure. Right. This is good enough. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but certainly there'd be a little bit of disappointment involved, you know, but like I went the opposite way and all of a sudden I'm sitting in this big machine, you know, with that famous Spy Hunter music playing out of speakers behind my head.
Nice.
And it had even the steering wheel. I mean, I don't know how old you are, so I don't know if you have a, you know what I'm talking about. But
yeah, I was born in 1980, so, you know.
Okay, 42. Yeah, you should be good then. So you remember Knight Rider?
Of course. The show. Oh, yeah.
And and remember the car, Kit, it wasn't really a steering wheel. It almost looked more like a yoke from an airplane.
Yeah,
and right. And that's what the Spy Hunter cab had. And then it had the three buttons on this not quite a steering wheel thing. For the oil slick and the smoke screen and the rockets or missiles.
That's neat. You know, what's really cool about those. What I love about arcades, and even now, but especially back then, they were experiences that you couldn't get at home. Truly could not get at a home console. And even now, my son, he's 6, and there's a arcade. I live right outside of Austin, Texas. And there's an arcade that's about 10 minutes away that's a huge fun center thing, you know, go-karts and axe throwing and all the arcade stuff you'd find today. But they have a pretty good section of retro cabinets, and probably about, last time I was there, like 50 or so, like a nice selection, like a really good selection. And he loved Pole Position, but the one you sit down in. You sit down, he could reach the pedals. The kid loves to race. He loves racing games. That's his jam. Every time we go to the arcade, he wants to play all the racing games. And I usually have to hit the gas for him because he can't reach the pedals.
Oh, yeah.
The Pole Position, sense. He was like, oh, this is because he could hit the pedals. He could reach them because they're just smaller. So there's something cool about those classic games, right? That, I don't know, they were just experiences you couldn't have at home. And that was neat that you were able to tie that with your friend's 5200.
That's pretty cool.
So I usually do a thing called the three questions, and I've done it for a while through this show. Oh. And early on, my main three questions was, if you had the opportunity to build an arcade in like a space the size of a decent sized garage, what would be the first three arcade games you'd put in that space?
Well, I mean, honestly, if I could have that, not the exact one, but if I could have a sit down Spy Hunter cabinet.
Right.
You know, that would have to go in there. But, cool. You know, it's interesting because when I think about stuff like that now, you know, my answer now might be different than it was a long time ago. But I think about like what are games where, you know, you can play a quote unquote arcade perfect port of a lot of games at home. But, you know, if there's something special about the cabinet, then not really. Right. You know, you can't really play it at home without getting a bunch of extra equipment involved. You know, because like I have an arcade cabinet, but it just has a joystick and buttons, right? So,
right. So
like something like Centipede, for example, you know, that might not be an obvious choice. Something like really Centipede, but you know, to have that that trackball, because even back then you had trackballs at home, but they didn't have that same weight that the trackball had in the arcade cabinet. So, I mean, that one kind of came to mind, and as lame as it might sound, like a Space Invaders cabinet, you know, just because it. And that's another game that I played on the Atari 5200. That was my introduction to Space Invaders. Right. But the cabinet, you know, way it used, I forgot exactly how the cabinet was set up. It was set up somehow so that it reflected the game screen onto a secondary surface so that it had like a fake background.
Okay.
To kind of make it look a little, because otherwise the game was just black and white, right?
Right.
So they kind of used this little trick inside the cabinet to make it seem like it wasn't black and white.
Yeah.
So
that's cool. I like that. I mean, the classics are classics. It's funny you mentioned trackballs too. Last time I was at that arcade, which was like maybe a month ago, they had a Marble Madness cabinet with the trackball.
Oh, and I don't think I've ever played Marble Madness in the arcade. That would be so awesome.
It's awesome. I spent a couple bucks playing because I love Marble Madness. It's one of my weird games I'm oddly good at.
Yeah.
For no reason, just I happen to be good at it. I had it as a kid on the NES. And every once in a while, I'll go on Twitch and just try to beat my record and whatnot. But playing it on a trackball was a really cool experience. I'm smacking the heck out of the thing, you know, because there's weighty. There's a lot of like, it's like a cue ball in there. It's a big, you know, hefty control. And, yeah, and that's why I like arcades. They're tactile. There's just something different about some of those games that you can't get at home. And that's why I like about arcades.
100%.
So, yeah, man. So at the arcade, you were playing a lot of games. You had a friend who had the Atari 5200 and making those connections. What was your first home console?
So then you got to move forward about 3 years to 1987. And that's when I got my first console. And I don't remember exactly how it came about, only because I don't feel like I'm the one that sort of initiated that conversation, like with my parents, you know, like, hey, I want to get it, whatever. I feel like it was kind of my dad that asked me like, oh, you know, don't you want to get, you know, a video game system? You know, and I thought, well, yeah, you know, maybe like he was thinking about getting me one for Christmas that year. And I remember that at one point we were at a mall, and this would have been probably in like, let's just say it was the summer of 87, because I don't really remember for sure. But we were in a KB Toys. You're old enough. You remember KB
Toys. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yep.
And you could still buy the Atari 2600 at this time. And it was like $30 or something, or maybe it was $49. It was the little one, the Atari 2600 Junior.
And okay.
It came with maybe like two cartridges in there. And so we walk in the store. We happen to already be at the mall, right? So we walk into the store and he sees that and he's like, oh, that's pretty cool. And he starts like talking to like the sales guy about it and asking all these questions. And in my head, I'm already getting all hyped up, like, oh man, I'm gonna get an Atari today, you know, because he really seemed kind of serious about it.
Wow. Okay.
And then he just says, okay, you know, thanks. And then we kind of walk out and I was like, oh, all right. I guess that's not happening. You know, I don't know what that was all about then. And I think it was probably subsequent to that, that my dad kind of brought that up with me like, oh, don't you want to get, you know, a video game system? And it had just so happened, I didn't know anybody that had a Nintendo yet. Hmm. So it wasn't really on my radar. And we happened to be visiting my grandparents, who I only saw like a couple of times a year. And so I didn't really know all the kids in the neighborhood, but my cousins were also there visiting and they were like local. And so they knew the kids in my grandparents' neighborhood.
Okay.
And so we all ended up going over to this kid's house and he had an NES. And that was the first time I ever saw one. And I was asking him because I'd never heard of, I guess I'd kind of never, like the name Nintendo, even though I had played Nintendo arcade games, you know, in the arcades, I don't think the name really registered that much with me.
Sure.
Like in my mind, like Sega was more of a name where I saw that and I was like, oh, those are the arcade guys. Cause right. I always kind of thought like the Master System to me looked cool, but again, it was 100% just name recognition. Well, not 100%. I mean, the Master System looks pretty cool, but
yeah,
we went over to this kid's house and played the Nintendo. And so I kind of told my dad about that. Oh, yeah, we played the system, whatever. It seemed pretty cool. And so he just said, well, let's jump in the car and just go over to Toys R Us and just like, you know, just sort of see what's doing, you know, like talk to the people. But I think he like made it clear to me, like, we're not getting one today. We're just going to go.
Right. We're just going to talk
do some
about
it.
Yeah. Like, research. Look, yeah.
Right. Because I really didn't know that much about it, you know.
Sure.
So we went over there and we talked to this guy and he answered all of our questions. And we were like, okay, thank you. And, you know, based on that, I told my dad, like, okay, that's what I want. Like, you know, for Christmas this year, I would like, you know, a Nintendo. And then after that, I saw right around when The Legend of Zelda came out.
Yep.
And they were running, I'm sure you've seen that commercial on TV that they're running on TV. It's, you know, you can see it on YouTube where it was like this guy, it's a weird commercial. Like the guy's in like an insane asylum, it seems like, or something.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really do a good job at all of communicating what the game is about.
No, it's just, there's like, I think it's, he's like sitting there screaming about just different elements of the game, like Tektites and
going
nuts. And there's like maybe like some screenshots on a brick wall. Like, yeah, this will sell it for the kids. Yeah.
But so based on that, because, you know, again, I have this sort of arcade game mindset. And so when he's talking about like, you know, Octoroks and Tektites, and it's showing, you know, gameplay footage, but, you know, Zelda is like, it's a single screen and then you walk to the edge of the screen and you move to another screen. The game doesn't really scroll, right? And so each time he says that, it's in like a different location in the game. And it gave me the impression that this is like an arcade game and it's showing you the different sort of boards from the arcade game. But I just thought that it looked cool.
Sure.
So sure. I asked my dad, I said, hey, can I get this Legend of Zelda game along with the NES? And he's probably like, oh, well, you know, we'll see or whatever.
Sure.
And then like one day he comes home from work. I think it was in like October and, you know, I'm already home from school, obviously. And he just tells me, you know, he gives me his car keys and he says, hey, can you go grab something out of the trunk for me? Which was pretty normal. Like he'd go to the store on the way home and then he'd come home and, hey, you know, there's a bag of dog food or there's some groceries in the trunk. Can you go get them? So like I thought nothing of it. I'm like, oh, sure. I'm just going to go grab some dog food or something. And so I go pop the trunk and there's like a big Toys R Us bag. And and inside of it was the NES control deck set.
Yes. I know so that set well. Yes.
Yeah. So you got Mario Brothers and two controllers.
Yep.
And then in the bag with that was a copy of The Legend of Zelda.
That's amazing. How cool is that? Not only did you get the Nintendo, you got everything you wanted. You got it before Christmas.
Yeah.
So you were able. What a cool surprise.
I guess that's why. I think part of it is he wanted to play it too. But
yeah, right?
I think definitely part of it was like, you know, you can surprise your kid on Christmas morning, but you can extra surprise your kid if you just randomly give it to him like one evening in October.
That's really cool. What a fun memory. And I'm glad your dad did the research. One of the very early episodes of this show is my best friend who tells a story of how when he got his Sega Master System, you know, he begged for it because he wanted to play Shinobi. And when he finally received it for Christmas, his dad had no idea that the games were separate. So he got the system, but he didn't get the games. There was he did not get Shinobi. He just got a Master System, but evidently there were games programmed into it. I had no
Snail
idea.
Maze.
Yeah, there's a couple of them there, and so he still was able to play it, but I always found that funny, like, you know, parents at that day, I'm a dad, and I'm up on, of course, all the latest stuff, so my kid can't fool me, you know, when it comes to games, but our parents didn't know. This is a brand new world for them. That's really, really, that's cool that he was able to do that. Did you end up playing a lot with your dad?
He lost interest pretty quick, I would say. The only game that we really played together that I remember anyway was we would play Super Mario Brothers two player. And, you know, I was always Mario and he was always Luigi. And, you know, we would take turns, but, you know, he wasn't very good. But it's just sort of an odd thing because I never saw him, you know, play games. You know, I'd go to the arcade, like I said, and they would be sitting in the bar and he never came into the arcade and like that I recall and played much of anything. The only thing I remember him playing was coming in and playing some skee ball.
Cause
he grew up in Brooklyn. And so I think, you know, they would go over to like Coney Island or whatever.
Sure.
When he was a kid and play skee ball. So he had some skee ball skills, but you know, the playing any kind of video games were kind of out of his realm.
That's fair.
But
that's fair.
Which is too bad. Like I said, that it was just such a cool place. They had, you know, like the Zoltar machine.
Oh yeah.
From Big. Mm-hmm. I don't think they had actually the Zoltar machine, but there were many machines like it.
Oh yeah.
And they had at least two. They had like those Nickelodeon machines where, you know, you'd stick in like a coin and stick your face up to it and turn a crank. And it would be like some, I mean, they weren't quite softcore. I don't want to go that far, but it would be like some lady like taking a bath
in like a
wooden bathtub, and it was all black and white because it was from like 1912.
Yeah. I've never seen those in the wild. I know exactly what you're talking about. The crank, right? Like,
right.
Exactly. You got the little pic, making the pictures go.
The other really, really cool thing about that place was, as I said, they had skee ball, but they had a candy shop. And you had to go into the arcade to get to the candy shop. And you went, it was like an old timey candy store where the shelves just had glass jars that were full of and they had like jawbreakers down, like it started at maybe like a half an inch in diameter at most, all the way up to something that was like the size of a cue ball. And I'm sure they must have had things like red ropes and all that kind of stuff in there.
Oh, yeah.
But that's what you spent your skee ball tickets on.
Wow.
Like you weren't getting like finger cuffs and, you know, like the sort of cheap toys like that. It was all, the only thing you could spend it on was candy. But as a kid, we all thought this is so much better.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need a plastic Hot Wheel or something. Like I'd rather have a little sack of jelly beans or something.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Why not? Right. And why get a spider ring or one of the finger traps that you know you're going to break in 2 minutes? Get a, yeah, awesome jawbreaker. Why wouldn't you? How fun. I was going to say, you probably, if your dad and his skee ball skills, you probably were, you know, pretty flush with tickets when you went to the arcade.
Imagine. For sure. Because, I mean, he didn't want them, right? Sure. So he just wanted to come show off or whatever and check me out. And so he would just do that. And then he would just turn around and just hand me the tickets.
That's funny. I love those old school memories of arcades. I remember one I used to go to. I'm from Northern New Jersey. And there was a place called, I think I bring this up on some episode, but it's been a while now. And there was this place called Bowcraft Amusement Park. And it was this small amusement park that had carnival rides, but they were permanent. They were stuck there. So imagine like a carnival that would come to your town, you know, and you have the Tilt-A-Whirl and the Scrambler and the bumper cars, but not the quality of like a Six Flags, you know, and we're not talking that quality. And it would leave and come back, but these things stay there. So they had like this fake boardwalk they made, and they had a little house that had arcade games in it. And this place was the dingiest, like lowest lit, like a, it was almost like a barn with like two levels of arcade games. And I always think back to that thinking, how did these things run in this dust and grime? But like you said, I guess in that era, games were everywhere. It was a big, big deal. They had the original Punch-Out, which you mentioned, the actual arcade Punch-Out, which is, I try playing it now. It seems impossible. I don't know how anyone played that. Back in the day.
I was terrible at it, but I was just chalked. I was really, really bad at video games when I was a kid. Like I had the enthusiasm, but I didn't have the skill. But you know, well, we're talking about, I was like 7 or 8 years old.
So sure.
What do you expect?
Right. I was going to ask you, how'd you do at Zelda, you know, as a kid?
The thing with Zelda, like I said, you know, I completely misinterpreted the type of game that it was because the only frame of reference I had for games was the arcade, right? So I'd never played an adventure game, right? Because I didn't know anybody at that time that had a home computer. So, you know, I hadn't played any of those kinds of games. And so when I put the game in and started playing it, I was just like, I don't even really understand what I'm supposed to be doing. And, you know, it came with that little hint book. So I think I, you know, got a little bit of a sense of what I was supposed to be doing.
Right.
But I think it wasn't for like a year maybe before I beat that game. Because like I knew some kid at school who had beaten it, and he wasn't really a friend. I just knew I knew him a little bit. We weren't like buddies or anything, but I knew like which gate he went out at the end of the day, like at 3 o'clock, you know, like he lived over there.
Yeah.
So he'd walk out that gate. And so as soon as school got out, I would like book it over to that gate and stand there to wait for him to come. And then I would say, oh, hey man, you know, I found the raft last night or whatever. Like, where do I get this or whatever? And, you know, usually he'd be able to tell me what to do. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
You had your own game counselor at school. That's awesome.
Exactly.
You had your own direct line. And I love how games back in those days, everything was a tribal knowledge unless you had like Nintendo Power. And if you had Nintendo Power, I had Nintendo Power. You were it. And actually, for me, even it broke down some social stratas. Like, you know, I was good at Final Fantasy, so I knew another kid who was good at Final Fantasy, and we would trade secrets just like that. But There's no way that kid would have ever have talked to me in second grade if it weren't for Final Fantasy. So sure. I find that interesting that you had a similar experience on the playground. Hey, we're not really pals, but I know we both play this game and I know you know what's going on. Hey, can you help me out? And he was probably happy to share the knowledge. You're like, hey, yeah, I'm pretty awesome at this game. I've beaten it, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, actually, I think I did like a video about that, sort of that topic on my little side channel about sort of having video game friends.
Yeah.
Where yeah. you don't really have any other point of commonality, but it's like, yeah. hey, I have an NES. You have an NES. You know, you have an empty house after school, but I'm allowed to come over, which is not, you know, when I was a kid, that wasn't normal, right? If somebody's parents weren't home, they weren't allowed to have company, but you know, this guy's dad didn't care. So I could go over to his house after school and, you know, we could just sit there and play, you know, Contra together or whatever.
That's but, cool.
Like I don't, and I used to go over to that guy's house a lot, but I couldn't even tell you his name now.
That's all we did. Yeah, I mean, I had friends who I didn't even really like that much, but, you know, he had DuckTales. And it's like, hell yeah, I'm going to go over and play DuckTales now. That sounds awesome. You know, so definitely, that was definitely a thing, too. That brought back a lot of memories again. Friends who were kind of sort of acquaintances, but they happen to have a game you liked. You know, that's pretty good. I remember the days of trading games, too. I don't know if you did a lot of that as a kid. Like, hey, well, you can have my Rad Racer. I'll take your DuckTales, you know, for a week.
Yeah, that's where things get kind of sad. But
oh no,
you know, well, you know, I didn't know a lot again about video games. I did not have Nintendo Power, so I really didn't have a lot of information. And I also had this weird, I'm not going to call it a policy, but you know, just generally speaking, I didn't want to get like for me getting a new Nintendo game was not common. You know, like I could maybe ask for them for my birthday or Christmas, but like that's about it.
Yeah,
and so like I felt like I don't want to waste my pick. Getting a game that I could probably just borrow from somebody,
absolutely. You know,
and plus, you know, this was, you know, that whole chip shortage thing, like 88, 89.
Yep.
So, you know, cause normally the way it would work is my parents would take me to a store and just tell me like, just pick one, you know, rather than me saying, oh, can you get me for Christmas Kid Icarus? And them finding it. It's just like, let's just get in the car and we'll go. And, you know, you're getting the game now. So whatever is available now, you can have it now. And, you know, so you'd go to Toys R Us and you'd look up there and like all of the sort of blue chip games were out of stock. That was just normal, right? Like you never saw like they never had Contra. They just had that blue tag in the little the little flappy thing that is just like, oh, sorry, you were out of stock on that one.
Yep.
And so you'd end up looking up at this wall of all these games where it's like, man, I don't, you know, I've never really heard of any of these games, you know, like, cause all the stuff I know about isn't here. And maybe if it was here, I'm not sure I'd want it anyway. Cause you know, my friend has that game. And so I would make like the worst mistake you can make really as a kid, which is just to buy a game based on the box art.
Oh no.
And I always say I had bad luck, but you can't really chalk that up to luck. You know, it's just bad decision making.
Well,
and so I ended up, I never had actually like until I started getting into like collecting, if I didn't really think of it as collecting at the time, but until I started getting into the idea of buying up, you know, NES games sort of in bulk once nobody cared about them anymore, I had a pretty modest collection of Nintendo cartridges. And you know, so anytime I would tell anybody like, hey, you want to trade games, you know, for the weekend, they would say, well, what do you have? You know, well, I had Super Mario Brothers. Well, everybody had that. I had Zelda. Everybody had that, too. After that, I had games like Ikari Warriors, Elevator Action, Super Pitfall, Donkey Kong Classics. And so you'd list those off and they would just be like, yeah, I don't.
Yeah, dude, come on.
I don't want any of those. And that was sort of like the rules, like, well, because then you'd say, well, just let me borrow a game then. And they'd be like, no, that's not how it works. You know, if you're not, why would I bother letting you borrow one of my games? Like the only person, well, that's not fair. There was two people. There was a kid at school that let me borrow Castlevania. That was awesome. But outside, and I think he let me borrow Excitebike also, like, you know, different time.
Yeah.
But aside from him, the only person I could ever borrow games from was Jonathan, the guy with the Atari 5200, because, you know, he, of course, got an NES as well. And, you know, once he had beaten a game and didn't care about it anymore, he didn't care. Hey, can I borrow, like, Kid Icarus? That's where I got Kid Icarus, was borrowing it from him. He didn't care because he wasn't using it, but he was, like, my best friend. So, you know, when you talk about people at school that really aren't your friends,
yeah,
why would they let you borrow something? I don't even really know you that well. Like, you have to give me something sort of as collateral.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because I hear tons of stories, especially because of my show. You know, people will tell me about, you know, when they were a kid, oh, I let some kid borrow, you know, such and such a game. And then, you know, they moved away 3 weeks later and they never saw it again. So
it happens.
Kids were rightfully protective of their games.
Absolutely. I don't think that ever happened to me. I think I had a copy of Castlevania from a friend, but I had it for way too long. But again, he was like a side friend, and he actually came to my door, like, asking me, hey, almost like the mob, like, hey, where's my game? Hey, buddy, where's my game at? And I had to, like, surrender it. We had it for, like, a month or something. Maybe he's dodging him in the hallways or something. I actually, unfortunately, I had to cop to – that happened to me as an adult. I was working in New York, and I had a friend in my office who – she was really into games. And she let me borrow the Orange Box for PS3, which is a horrible port, by the way, of Half-Life and all that. But I wanted to play Portal and Half-Life 2, and I just held on to it. You know, it was one of those, like, just forgot about it, you know, played it. Oh, that's great. And I moved away, and it ended up in a box somewhere. And then fast forward, like, 10 years, I'm going through boxes. Oh, no, I still have her copy of the Orange Box on PS3, and I've long lost contact. I mean... work friend kind of thing, right?
Right.
So I couldn't even tell you her name, to be honest. So
I don't think that's as bad when you're adults, though.
Probably not. I mean,
she could replace that if she really wanted.
If she really was desperate for it, or could have asked for it, and I'm like, oh, geez, sorry about that. Here you go. But I was notorious for that when I was growing up. You know, borrowing something and just forgetting to return it. You know, until asked about it four months later. So that's a pretty interesting, the borrowing of games. Yeah, you had to have the collateral. You had to have the stuff in place. Before we continue with the conversation, I just want to thank my wonderful patrons for their continued support of this podcast. As always, it is greatly appreciated. Starting with Greg Stewart of the Player One Podcast, Pete Harney, Ryan Payne of Gamers Week Podcast, Dan of Retrologic, Seth Sergil of the All In Podcast, Games with Coffee, Patrice Millette, The Let's Play Princess, BT Goebbels, Tim Knowles of The Letus, and finally Julian of Nerds Without Pants. If you want to join these wonderful individuals, please sign up at patreon.com/agamerlooksat440. Check out the tiers, and if something strikes your fancy, by all means, sign up today. And if not, a rating or review on your pod player of choice is always greatly appreciated. Let's jump back into the conversation. Let's kind of talk a bit about some of those tentpole games in your kind of, as you kind of progress through the systems, et cetera. And then I'd love to chat with you about, again, your content creation and the history of your channel and how that all came to be. So what would you say of, you know, all the games and systems and franchises, what was the moment where you said, or the game that made you, turned you from a hobbyist into like a fan? If that makes sense, that actually cemented to you, yes, this is something that I don't just do for fun on the weekends or after school. This is something I really kind of love, because as somebody who makes YouTube videos, clearly you have a strong connection to this medium that a lot of people don't. So what was the game that you think that put that nail in and said, yes, this is my thing?
Boy, I mean, I don't think I can say like there's a particular game. I just think, you know, growing up, I was, you know, one of the more sort of socially awkward kids who just gravitated towards, you know, video games and then later on to computers. And, you know, I think you find some kid that's into the same stuff as you are, and, you know, you just hang out with him and you don't worry about all the other social stuff going on at school, you know, cause you're too awkward for that anyway. So, you know, from the time I got my NES, I would say that, you know, gaming was like one of the main things that we did. I mean, back then, you know, you'd have an NES, but you'd still go outside, you know, and ride bikes and, you know, play or whatever and do stuff like that.
Yeah, totally.
And, you know, the same was true, you know, like later on, you know, I got a Genesis, you know, when I was in high school, And I was lucky enough to have a computer that I could play video games on as well. So it was just, you know, it was just always one of the main things that I did. So, you know, video games were just such a big part of my childhood.
And it's interesting because people our age, we grew up with it and the medium grew up with us. It kind of followed us through, I feel at least, our growing up, right? As we got older, the games kind of evolved with us. So I think that's why people like us really have this strong connection that I don't know if my son, you know, is going to have with it. His games are already at a point where, you know, this is the golden era of games. You can play whatever you want, whenever you want. It's all available and there, depending on how much effort you want to put through. I think for us, we grew up with it. You know, it was always alongside. So let's kind of take it into your channel. I would just love to learn. From what I can research, your first videos came out around 2013. Does that sound accurate?
Yeah, I think it was July of 2013. Cool. It's funny because I always forget. And then it's like, you know, people who follow my show who will kind of remind me, hey, your anniversary's coming up.
Oh, nice.
Which, you know, this year is the 10-year anniversary. So hopefully.
Oh, cool.
You know, I should put a reminder on my phone or something because I should probably try to do something for that.
I was going to say, are you planning anything for the 10-year anniversary or is this like
No, I mean, I've done live streams for, you know, my anniversary before. But other than that, you know, I'm not going to do some kind of like retrospective of my own channel or anything. That seems a lot more of an egotistical move than anything I would ever do. So
a little self-indulgent, I guess. Yeah.
Right.
That's fair. So what inspired you to start the channel?
I mean, you know, so for me, like my whole attitude about my show is it just seemed like a fun, creative thing to do, you know, the same way that somebody takes up, you know, painting or drawing or, you know, playing the guitar or something. I had gotten into watching, I don't know if you're familiar with Classic Game Room.
To a certain extent. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's not really around anymore, but you know, Classic Game Room was like the original internet video game show, like predating YouTube. But then at some point he kind of relaunched his show after YouTube became a thing. And somehow I just found it. You know, I was still into classic games, and this would have been like, you know, I don't know, 2011 or so. And, you know, so I would just look for like, oh, who's on YouTube that's doing, you know, like reviews of old games or whatever. And, you know, that was a channel that I found where I just kind of, I liked the guy's, you know, attitude and personality. And so I started watching it. And at the same time, I started listening to a couple of podcasts, video game podcasts. And it just made me think, you know, I think I'd like to try doing this. I mean, even I was watching YouTube stuff that had nothing to do with gaming, but it still made me just think, you know, I'd like to try making a video and seeing how that would be. But, you know, I think it was Classic Game Room was sort of the thing that really pushed me over. Like, I'm going to try to make a video, because really, if you watch my early videos, it was just me doing Classic Game Room.
Yeah, like reviews and such. The first one that's actually on your channel, I'm not sure if there's been stuff taken off or not, is the TNC Surf Designs
That's the first one. I've got one video I think that is unlisted.
Okay.
Because it kind of got replaced.
Uh-huh, sure.
But I've never taken any of my videos down. So no, that was, and that, you know, earlier when I was kind of rattling off the NES games that I had, that's another game that I had when I was a kid. And so that's why I reviewed it. I just thought, oh, this will be funny. Like, I'll review this game that I had when I was a kid that I maybe wasn't the hugest fan of.
Right. Yeah, no, I really liked it too. I actually watched it this morning, kind of just doing my due diligence for this conversation. And there's a lot of, no, it's actually, it's not though. It's very, because I've been watching YouTube since, you know, its inception and internet videos. And of course I went through the standard, you know, progression of internet personalities, your AVGN, and kind of going through that cycle, I guess. And when I watched that initial video, there is an air, a bit of professionalism, and it's not embarrassing, because I, you know, read stuff I wrote, you know, 10 years ago, and I'm like, oh Lord, please let no one see this. Let this be buried on the internet. Yeah. I please just cover this with dirt. But I enjoyed it because it had a air of professionalism, and there wasn't a sense of and this is permeates, I think, throughout all your videos, which is why I like your channel so much, nothing seems sensationalized. It's just you talking about a game or talking about a system when you're doing the quarterlies in a very approachable, professional manner. It's not this heightened, you know, that YouTube can be.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that. Is that like an intentional choice, or is it more of just the way you are and your personality and choosing? Well,
I think my overriding philosophy for making videos is like, I want to make the kind of videos that I would want to watch if I wasn't the one who made them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
And like, I don't, what you just said about, you know, people who get sort of overly sensational and like have to, you know, overemphasize everything and act, you know, wacky or whatever. I personally can't stand that. Mm-hmm. Like, no disrespect to those people, because obviously there's an audience for it, but I'm not that audience. And so for me, it's just like, I want to make the kind of videos that I would want to watch. And, you know, what was I watching? I was watching classic Game Room. And that's really how he was. You know, he would make jokes, but it was all very sort of dry humor. And, you know, him just sort of talking about the video and or talking about the video game. And so that's what I did, you know.
That's awesome, man. So what was the first, and again, going through, it's hard to kind of track just looking at, you know, view counts and things like that, because you never know when these things blow up. What was the first video that really took off, you know?
Yeah, so I believe it was my third launch video. It was the launch of the Sega Saturn. I wouldn't swear that was the third, I think it was, but it was the launch of the Sega Saturn, and it just happened to be this way that I finished making the video on like Christmas Eve. And so I uploaded it thinking, you know, I'm going to just release this video on Christmas morning and just see what happens. You know, like, to me, that sounded like a horrible idea. But nobody watched my show anyway. And so I'm like, well, who cares? Like, I'll just upload it on Christmas morning. You know, what could happen? And so I did. And, you know, I checked it sometime later and I was like, oh my God. And like, I showed my wife, I'm like, look at this. This video has like 10,000 views. Like the same day, which now it wouldn't probably be that, you know, remarkable. But at the time, it was like, oh my God, like people are, you know, somehow the algorithm picked that video up and was showing it to people.
Interesting.
And it was pretty cool, you know, because it got me motivated, you know, to like that very day. I don't even remember what year that was, but I just remember that very day I started working on the Super Nintendo launch video.
Wow. So that really said, oh, okay, I have something here.
I just really knew that I felt like I had something with those launch videos. Like, I think I made the first one, and it's funny, the first one came out of, the idea for that came out of a podcast that a friend of mine and I were going to do that we just never did. Mm-hmm. That was going to be just nothing but talking about console launches. And so I ended up, it was obvious we weren't going to do it. And so I just ended up telling him like, hey, you know, I'm going to take all this research that I already did and I'm going to use it to make a video for my channel, unless you have like some kind of major objection. And he said, yeah, I don't care. And, you know, so I made, and the format really has never changed. It's like, here, I'm going to talk about, you know, the lead up and the development of the system, and then, you know, the release of the system. And then I'm going to sort of do, you know, I don't call them reviews, but like a showcase of all of the games that were out on launch day.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did that. The Sega Genesis was first. And after that, I don't remember. I think it was the Sega Genesis and then like the PlayStation, the TurboGrafx-16. Yeah. I don't remember the order. And I think, so maybe the Saturn might have been the fourth one.
I'm looking through it. And it seems like the Saturn is the fourth one. Yeah. So,
yeah. But that was the first one that anybody really watched.
It's cool. I was actually watching it today, again, going through it, because Sega Saturn's a thing I don't know much about. You're right that there's still a through line, and obviously as you improve as you continue, right? You're always making improvements and pacing and things like that, but you can still tell that the core of it's still there. Doing it as a quarterly, I'm assuming that was an intentional choice. Was that due to time or just the sheer time? Because especially in that era, you know, seven years ago, the big thing was flooding the market with videos, just three videos a day. And usually those videos were often terrible, right? But you chose to do another tact.
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning, I was, you know, I would make an entire video in one day at the beginning.
Sure.
Not a launch video, mind you. Like the that TNC Surf Designs video, or I did like, what was it, like Sequest or something for the Atari 2600?
Yep. Sequest.
Like stuff like that where, you know, I had sort of my script and I would memorize the script and I would, you know, I would sit. I had my own little, this little setup that I always would use. If you watch those early videos, I sat in this corner of my office where I had a shelf of games, because you got to have a shelf of games behind you on
YouTube. Gotta do it.
On one side, and then I had a little sort of table type thing on the other side where I would kind of set stuff up on the table so that it, you know, went along with whatever the topic was that day. But once I got it set up, I recorded, you know, like the intro was totally, you know, scripted, and I would just memorize it. And I would sit there and do it. And then I would record gameplay footage into a DVD recorder back then.
That's how I would capture
gameplay footage.
Very nice.
Because I already had it.
Yeah.
Like the only things I had to buy when I started my show were I didn't own a microphone. And I don't think I knew USB microphones were a thing, because they must have been a thing by then. But I bought a non-USB, an XLR microphone, and I actually bought the mixer that I'm still using that my voice is going through right now.
Oh, cool.
And then I bought like a little really, really basic USB audio interface just so that I could get, you know, the sound into the computer.
Sure.
And everything else I had. Neat. So
that's really cool.
But I would do the whole thing. I would do that. I would record the gameplay footage. And then I didn't even write a script for like the second part of the video where I was showing gameplay footage and just saying things, you know. I would just chop up gameplay footage and put it into the editing software. And then I would record voiceover directly into the editing software.
Right.
And that wasn't really scripted.
That's interesting.
I would just sort of come up with a line and just say it.
That's, you know, but it, and it's funny because, you know, you can tell things are scripted, right? But I honestly wouldn't have thought that you were doing a lot of that just off the cuff, because it really does come across very seamless.
I'm saying it's not like I did the whole thing in one take.
I would just
kind of sit there and be like, okay, totally. I'm going to say this, and I would just hit record and then just say whatever line I'd come up with on the spot.
Yeah, you weren't doing it all in one go.
But all of that, to get back to the topic, my point in all of that is that back then it was just like I'd make a video that day. And then the next day, I think that if you look, I'm sure there are times when I released videos on consecutive days, because the next day I'd be like, okay, today I'm going to do a video on whatever. And I was able to do that. And that was purely because those videos were easy to make, because they have like zero production value.
Sure. Yeah, but the intro and the outro and
Yeah. But again, I can't emphasize this enough. Like, nobody was watching my show. So there was really no pressure to like, oh, I have to get more videos out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I started getting the idea of like, well, what if I made longer form videos? You know, because I think all the launch games. I made like sort of a retrospective of what was then all three Streets of Rage games. Nobody watched that either, but which is fine. that was a video like kind of after that, as I had started kind of learning more about making videos. That was one where I really wish I'd waited.
Was there a video that you can recall where the production of it was either really challenging or fraught with issues or problems? Because I always find that pretty interesting, the perseverance of making these things. Because again, your videos are very detailed and they're interesting and they're paced well and exhaustively researched, which again is why I enjoy them so much.
Yeah.
There had to have been some speed bumps in some of those. I sometimes find that pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning, the sort of the speed bump was that I literally did not know what I was doing.
Sure. Yeah.
Like I had never made a video and I didn't know how to set up lights and I didn't know how to really use it. Like I had a camera, but I used it to take pictures, you know?
Sure. So,
you know, I didn't know what I was doing. And then I went through this period where I feel like I got enough of an idea of what I was doing that, you know, that got easier. And I hadn't gotten to the point where the videos got to where they are now. You know, like I think the first launch video I made, which is that's the one that's unlisted now, was the launch of the Sega Genesis.
Okay.
And I bet that video didn't take me even a week to make.
Wow.
Because at that point, it's like it wasn't really researched that well. I mean, actually, in some ways it was, because I got the launch lineup correct, which all the information you see online back then, and even to a certain extent now, the launch lineup is wrong.
Really? But, interesting.
Yeah. But I had that correct, and so I was pretty proud of that. But other than that, it got really easy to make. I feel like I have more, you know, hurdles, if you want to call it that, now, just because it's gotten to the point where, you know, something like the launch of the Dreamcast, or that, because that was the last launch video I made. I don't mean that's the last one I'm going to make.
Right.
The last one I've made, or like that PlayStation in 1995 video.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They take so much time, like hundreds of hours to make. And you get to this point making the video where you just like, you're just completely burnt out.
Yeah. I can imagine.
Because, you know, when I'm in the middle of making it, it's okay. It's too late to stop and say like, this is too much work.
Yeah.
But you can't see the finish line either. Yeah, and so all you can do is, you know, I have a day job. Some people, for some reason, think I'm able to do YouTube full time, which I don't, and I don't want to, but
fair.
You know, so I go do my job, I come home, and I would have dinner with my wife, and then I would literally work another 8 hours on the video and go to bed at like, you know, 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And you do that and there's no end in sight. And that's hard, you know.
Well, especially if you're a one person show, obviously there's no production schedule, it sounds like it's just done when it's done. Right. I mean, obviously, I'm sure you outline, you have it all structured out. And you no. Can't, no? Okay.
Well, I mean, the first thing I do is write the script.
Sure. Right.
So I guess in that sense, yes.
Yeah.
But like, I have never worked in like the industry. Right. And I feel like, you know, I talked about Classic Game Room. Mm-hmm. That guy, Mark, was a professional video editor.
Sure.
And then, you know, probably my sort of best friend on YouTube is Corey from My Life in Gaming. Professional video editor. And then, you know, another friend of mine is Joe from GameSack, professional video editor.
Right.
Whereas I'm like totally self-taught. And so I feel like if I ever showed one of these guys what my workflow looks like, they'd be like horrified. Because I'm just kind of just doing stuff.
Get it done.
Like I don't, there's no organization to it at all. Because I don't, you know, I've never taken a class on like, here's the workflow you should use and blah, blah, blah. I just don't know.
And that's fine. And, you know, and that, because the work comes out good, you know, and it's, I do find it very interesting, the effort, because obviously these videos require effort. You know, they can't be this good without that effort. Right. But yeah, that 8 hours. Yeah. I mean, that's just the grind. And I can totally see, you know, when is this going to be done? But you know, it's not done until it's done. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I mean, this is probably the worst I can think of is, cause like you said, you know, I don't have deadlines, right? In fact, I've even learned, like, I don't really tell people that much what I'm doing anymore because I don't want to set these expectations. Like, oh, he's working on the launch of whatever or doing whatever. Like, I just kind of do my stuff and I don't like try to tease the viewership anymore.
Sure.
Cause it's like, yeah, I'm working on this, but you know, even back in the day with that Super Nintendo launch video, I told you I started it on Christmas Day. And that video came out on like the 4th of July.
Wow.
But anyway, so normally there's no deadlines, but there was this one year where my wife and I were going on vacation for like 3 weeks. And I was working on, it was the launch of the Sega Master System. And I was like, I want to have this out before we leave. Cause we were going on vacation over Christmas and the holiday season is a big time for releasing videos. If you care about ad revenue and, you know, I don't do this for the money, but if I put that much work into something, it would be nice if I could release it at a time where it's going to get sort of that maximum ad revenue when it gets that first, rush of views.
Right.
And so I'm like, okay, I have to have this video out before we leave. But then I was thinking, okay, I already did the Sega Saturn. And I think that video is, I'm not saying now, but at the time I thought that video was pretty good. So I was happy with it. And I already did the Genesis, but that was the first video I ever did. And I didn't think that really held up anymore. And now I'm making the Sega Master System video, which, you know, if this is anytime, if this is the video I'm working on today, it's probably going to be the best video, you know, based on certain standards that I've ever made. Cause it's sure. Like today is the day that I know the most about how to make videos.
Right. Yeah, right? Totally.
So, I mean, every video I've made is a product of whatever skill level I was at the time the video came out. And in my mind, I'm like, okay, people are going to watch this Sega Master System. Because I'm thinking maybe this will bring on, like, new viewers.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
So people are going to watch this Sega Master System video. And then logic tells me that they'll probably, and I don't think this is actually true, but this is, in my mind, this is what everybody's going to do. Then they're going to go watch the Sega Genesis video, which I think is awful, you know,
sure.
From a quality standpoint.
Sure.
So I'm like, oh, I can't do that. Like, I can't have people watch that video after watching the Master System video. So I'm like, all right, the only thing I can do is redo the Genesis video too.
Interesting. Okay.
So, but you know, our trip is coming up, man.
Yeah.
You know? And so like, okay, I got to finish this Master System video, which is like taking forever. And then somehow I have to also completely from scratch remake the Genesis video.
Wow.
And then have them both ready to go before I get on the airplane. And when I say redo the Genesis video, I'm not saying I like recycled the script and just, you know, used better. I mean, I completely from the ground up made a whole new video.
Wow.
And so I had days where I was getting like 3-4 hours of sleep.
Wow.
Cause I was just up like all night just doing that stuff,
cranking it out,
work and coming home and doing it again.
Oof.
And, I mean, that's hard, you know. Yeah. It was hard for my wife too, because,
sure,
you know, it's like, hey, you should be a little more focused on like, we're going on this 3-week trip.
Sure.
You know?
Right.
And I'm like, oh, I know. But I got to get this done first. It was like kind of I was getting compulsive about it, which I don't normally have that, kind of personality, but I just really felt strongly that this is what I need to do. So I was able to do it, but I'm saying it was, I think the morning our plane left, I took I made the thumbnail for the Genesis launch.
Wow.
Video, it was the last thing I needed to do.
Ooh, wow. That's incredible. Working on two major projects. My question was going to be, well, did you reuse the script? No, you just from the ground up. Wow.
I didn't even have it.
Interesting.
I didn't.
Yeah.
This goes back to like a workflow thing, but it never occurred to me to save anything.
Why would you? It's done. I'm
and
not going to
so
look at this
I'd have
again.
A folder. Yeah. Right. I'd have a folder on my desktop. It would have the text file for the script in it.
Right.
It would have all the gameplay footage in it. And it would have whatever pictures and videos I downloaded.
Right.
And then I'd finish the video. It was uploaded. Is everything okay with it? Yes. Okay. Delete the project out of my video editor and then take that entire folder and drag it to the trash.
That just panics me. I have stuff I've worked on 10 years ago. I cannot throw anything away.
But that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
But like, I didn't even know, because like now I have it down. But see, I had to learn this myself.
That's fair. That's so interesting.
That, you know, I have an 8-terabyte hard drive.
Sure.
That's just for my show. And then anything, if I'm working on a video, if I take, you know, gameplay footage or pictures, whatever assets, they get put in the folders where they belong permanently first. And then I bring them in, you know, to the video editing software.
Yep.
And so then when I'm done, you can just export. There's like an XML file you can just export from Final Cut. And then that's all you have to save. And then the rest,
right,
you know, you can delete the project, because if you reload that XML file, it'll go into your file system and bring all those assets back in.
Cool.
I didn't know about any of that.
See, that's so interesting.
So like for the Genesis, I had to re-record all the Genesis gameplay footage, which is good, because by then I was using, I was capturing with like a proper capture card, and I bought a FrameMeister. That's why I bought a FrameMeister, was so I could capture gameplay footage for the show.
Gotcha.
So, I mean, it was an upgrade all around. So I'm glad I did it.
That's very interesting. We are coming up on time a little bit. I just want to hit a couple more, you know, questions if I can. Firstly, you know, obviously you have a pretty great body of work as it sits right now. Lots of great videos out there on a variety of topics, from obscure stuff to, to the big launch videos. Your biggest video as of this recording was your N64.
Which I think I never would have thought that.
I was going to ask.
When I made it.
How does that hit you? It's got 3.1 million views as of this recording.
Yeah.
And it's the one that introduced me to your channel.
Oh, really?
Probably around 5 years ago or so. That kind of tracks with my hazy recollections. When you see that 3.1 million views, how does that hit you? Like, it just...
You know, it's hard to say just because, you know, I say this like a broken record. I never started making videos because I had any expectation or intent that it was going to go anywhere.
Right.
It was just fun. They were fun to make.
Sure.
Like, especially if you watch like the early stuff, I was just being like, I had that explosive diarrhea video because there's a homebrew game for the 2600 called Explosive. I'm gonna review Explosive Diarrhea.
Why not?
And you know, I had my little table and I put some toilet paper on it. I went to the store and bought a bottle of Pepto Bismol to put there.
Yep.
There's videos that never got finished and released where I had other crazy ideas that involved me having to go. You know, I had this one idea for a video where like I was going to dress up. I don't know if you know who Mills Lane is. He was a famous boxing referee.
Oh yeah, sure. Yep.
And so I went out and I bought, he always wore that short sleeve white shirt with a black bow tie.
Yep.
So I went out and got those and I bought like one of those like toy wrestling rings that they sell for like WWF figures. Uh-huh. And I like redecorated it so that it said Classic Gaming Quarterly on the sides.
That's cool. Okay.
Because I had this whole idea, I'm going to make these videos where it's going to be like, you know, two games go into the ring, only one game comes out. You know, is it going to be, is it going to be F-Zero X or Wipeout 64?
Sure.
You know, and I recorded a lot of the episode and I realized this is so stupid. And so I didn't ever finish it. And it's funny because that wrestling ring, I kept it for a long time because I'm like, what am I going to do with this thing? Because I had to make Classic Gaming Quarterly like banner stickers to put on it.
Sure.
You know? And I'm like, what am I going to do with this thing? You know? And so I ended up donating it to Goodwill. And I kind of wonder where that is right now. Or if does whoever have it, they look at that and go like, what the heck is Classic Gaming Quarterly?
Is this? Someone ends up in like Spokane, Washington. You know, you're like, what?
Yeah.
Why do I own this
thing? I don't know if you watch RMC. It used to be Retro Man Cave. Now it's just RMC.
No, I haven't.
He's a British guy. He does this show, recurring show called This Week in Retro. And I thought it was funny when he started doing that because I'm like, hey, that was my idea, but I never told anybody.
Uh-huh.
Like I was going to do this weekly show called This Week in Retro Gaming, and it was supposed to be like the Daily Show, but for retro gaming. And the same thing, I recorded at least part of an episode. And it's funny, anybody, if you go watch the trailer for my show, I made the trailer for my show like years ago. So everything in the trailer is like old, but I just love that trailer. And I've just never, nobody watches trailers for YouTube channels anyway, in my opinion.
No, is that not
and so
that
I've
a
just,
thing?
I just leave it.
Yeah.
But it's got a shot of me dressed like Mills Lane because I was, you know, and it's got two like quick like clips out of the This Week in Retro Gaming show that never happened, which is, I think, part of the reason I leave the trailer up is I can look at that and be like, oh, I remember when I
cool.
was going to do that.
That's cool. I love that. It's interesting you talk
I forgot. Yeah, go ahead, sorry. I forgot what question I was even
answering. Oh, it's fine. It's totally fine. I think that's really interesting. We were talking about the N64 video and kind of how that hit you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, that was my point is I was just goofing off. Like, it's a long story I'm not going to tell, but basically I had this job that involved me sitting around my house a lot waiting for like the phone to ring. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, imagine like, I don't know if you're old enough to remember the Maytag man commercials.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Where like the Maytag man sitting there, like, oh, Maytag is so dependable. This guy doesn't even have any work to
right.
do. And like, that was me. I got paid a salary to sit at home and wait for somebody to break something.
Wow.
And so I'm like, what am I going to do? You know, after a while it was just like, I could play video games, but I wanted to do something a little more active.
Right.
And so I just started making videos as a way to goof off and, cool. You know, and sort of the popularity of my channel. I mean, it took a long time, you know, I mean, I had less than 100 subscribers for a really long time and I just didn't, it's not why I was doing it. So I didn't care, but you know, like I said, that sort of the moment that Sega Saturn video happened, it's not like I didn't think it was cool, but I don't know. I get, your original question was, what do I think when I see that I have a video that has over 3 million views? And like, I guess if I'm being honest, I don't really think anything.
That's fair.
I just look at that and just be like, wow.
Yeah.
You know,
that's like, fair.
Wow.
I think it's interesting. You made that during a time though, where you had the time and at that time when you made that, you said you didn't have many subscribers. You were still super small and just putting out these videos. And was that the one that really said, okay, kind of pushed you over that edge almost?
I think it did because, like I said, I said, nobody is making videos like this, like launch videos.
Yeah.
Like I found, here's a little, you know, people are doing like single game. At that point, single game reviews were kind of like becoming passe. And, you know, people were starting, you know, like the Video Game Historian was around and he was doing that kind of stuff. He had a few other people making sort of meatier content like that. But nobody was saying, I'm going to focus on console launches. And I thought, like, that's just a really cool little story to tell. And you could watch that and it transports you back to, you know, September 9th, 1999 or whenever it is. And I just thought, like, that's neat. And so when I finally got one that, you know, like I said, the algorithm picked it up and like it kind of went somewhere. I felt like that was, to me, it was like confirmation. Yeah, you were onto something.
Yeah, and it's fantastic. And again, that's the one that introduced me to your channel probably around when it launched, because again, the algorithm picked it up and pushed it out. And I always equate your stuff with, you know, Video Game Historian, like kind of in that realm of content and videos where it is meatier and you just learn a bunch of stuff. And I just find that stuff fascinating and interesting. And it's, you're delivering information in a very, again, professional and interesting way. And it's the pacing. It's just,
thank you.
Good stuff. It's right up
that,
my alley.
That being, I appreciate that. Thank you. That being said, Norm's the man. And as far as I'm concerned, the two channels I can think of, you know, that make gaming content that, in my opinion, just quality wise, are head and shoulders above everybody else, it's Norm and it's My Life in Gaming.
Yeah.
Like I watch either of their shows and I just think like, wow, like I wish I could do that.
Yeah. I mean, Norm's video on the Link's Awakening, it's just gorgeous. I mean, it's phenomenal. I've seen it several times, right? Like
I think his videos would be at home on PBS.
Yeah, totally. And it has that vibe, and they would absolutely, sounds like it would belong for sure.
I mean, I think that's the vibe he's going for.
Which is
great.
He's 100%
nailed it.
Yes, he absolutely nailed it. But man, I definitely put your stuff in that kind of category of that meteor content that whenever a new video comes out, you know, launch video, really anything. Like I'm really enjoying your Let's Read series. I think it's really unique and fun. And especially going through old EGMs, it kind of reminds me of, I didn't have that magazine when I was a kid. My friends did. And it was I was always like a little jealous because I had Game Pro and Nintendo Power. And especially as I got older, my friends again who had EGM was like, oh man, I wish my mom would get me EGM, you know. So it's always cool to kind of go on those journeys with you and walk through them. It's really fun.
Yeah, thanks.
With our last question before we part ways, and man, I could do this for hours, but I won't take more of your time. Lots of people, of course, are still starting YouTube channels. People are still, and it's a huge, you know, it's the landscape is, and I don't make YouTube videos. I know nothing about creating videos. Like this is the thing I know how to do, but the landscape, of course, has completely changed in the last 3 years, never mind 5, 7, 9 years. What advice would you give somebody? And I think we've sprinkled this around this conversation, so I can maybe just end on this thought. What advice would you give somebody who's looking to start a YouTube channel for the first time? They have an idea. They just have an itch to make something and share something. Like, what advice would you give somebody when they're just starting out? To just get the ball rolling.
A common thing that I see with people who are just starting out making, I'm not a huge fan of the word content.
Same.
It's convenient. It sounds so generic.
I know, but it's convenient, but that's fair.
Yeah.
I totally agree.
So I'll just say whether it's the two big things, right? It's YouTube and it's podcasts.
Right.
Right. And a common thing I see with people is they're just starting out and their primary concern is how do I grow my channel, or how do I grow my show and get more viewers? And unless you've already got everything else nailed down, like if you're somebody who's already a professional, you know, video editor, and you've got experience writing, and you really think like, I'm just making like grade A content and I'm looking for the audience, that doesn't describe the vast majority of people, right? Right. There are people like me who have, they're just like, you know, knuckleheads who don't know what they're doing. And so don't even worry about the fact that nobody's watching your show. Like, be happy that nobody's watching
right.
your show.
Yeah, fair.
Because the thing about if it's a podcast or it's YouTube or whatever, everything you do is public, right? If you took up watercolor painting or whatever, for example, you're doing that in the privacy of your own home for years and years. And maybe finally you get to a point where like, you know, I think I could, you know, share some of my work at like the local, you know, co-op gallery or something.
Right. Yeah.
Right. But up until then, nobody had to see all the stuff that you did that sucked. Right.
That's very true.
But when you're doing something like this, everybody, you know, it's available to everybody. Right. So be happy that you can sort of operate in obscurity, because nobody wants to make like practice YouTube videos that they're never going to upload. Right. Because like, you know, back at, I'd be happy if one person commented on the video. It's like, hey, somebody watched the video and actually left a comment. Right. Right? So you like that. But, you know, if I had made like that TNC Surf Designs video and like 10,000 people had watched that, I probably would have been mortified. So,
yeah.
So thing number one is just worry about what you're doing and don't worry about, you know, whether or not anybody's watching it. Just, you know, if you're somebody that starts off and you have an idea, right? Like I didn't have the idea for making launch videos. I mean, it's not even really, it wasn't 100% my idea, but it wasn't something that came along until later. But if you have an idea that you believe in, like then stick to it and don't worry about the fact that nobody's watching it. Just, you know, try to get better. You know, every video you make, find some way to make it better than the last one that you made. And if you keep doing that, then, you know, hopefully an audience will come. But, you know, part of the reason I think that I'm, you know, I don't get real, you know, excited about the fact that my show gets as many views as it does is like, I think that there's a lot of things that happen that are outside your control.
Absolutely.
It's no different than if you want to break into the music industry, if you want to break into the acting, you know, you want to be like a movie actor, a TV actor. You know, it's very possible that some of the best actors out there or best musicians out there are doing so in obscurity, because it's like you got to catch a break.
Yeah.
And like with YouTube, and probably with, I don't know, is like, I have a podcast, but I'm very, you know, ignorant about how it really all works. You know, you rely on an algorithm that somebody else made to hopefully pick up what you're doing and show it to enough people that, you know, you end up getting an audience. But you can do everything right and never have that happen. Yep. And if you're really only in it because like, well, I want an audience or I want to make money on YouTube, then, you know, there's a very, very good chance that you're just going to end up disappointed. And it's sad because, you know, I've seen really, really good shows or heard really good shows, you know, in podcast form quit because they just felt like, well, nobody's listening. You know, and it's especially hard with podcasts because, you know, all you can really look at is like, well, how many downloads do I have?
Right.
You know, you don't really get interaction. And for some people, they just feel like, well, I'm just wasting my time. But if you say that, well, then why were you doing it in the first place?
That's a really interesting insight. It's, and you're dead on. You can't control it. It's hard because it's also hard too for people, and hard for me as well, you know, looking at numbers and seeing trends and stuff. I try not to, I don't look at statistics on the show. I see download numbers because Buzzsprout puts it in my face every time I log in so I can see them. But as far as like where are people listening and how, I can't, right? Because the focus can't be on that, because if it's not meeting a weird expectation I have in my head, then it's going to be demoralizing. So I think your focus on just make sure the work is good.
Yeah.
As good as you can make it at that moment. And then.
Yeah. And are you enjoying making?
And enjoying the process, right?
You know?
And enjoying the little wins. Like, and
I mean, yeah. I still enjoy working on my show, or, you know, when it comes to like the podcast, you know, people listen to the podcast and that's awesome. But for me, it's just like I get to sit down for, you know, 90 minutes a week and talk to my good friend. Yeah. So,
and that's awesome.
If somebody wants to hang out and listen to that, that's great. But I don't, I'm not going to ever say like, ah, oh, we're only getting so many downloads. This isn't worth it anymore. You know, because if that's how you feel, you didn't start it for the right reason.
Absolutely. Totally agree. Thanks again to Chris from Classic Gaming Quarterly for taking the time to chat with me about his history with games, and I hope you had as much fun listening to the conversation as I did having it. Thanks again for listening to A Gamer Looks at 40. Follow me on all the socials, and until next time, continue being awesome.